So you missed the January 31st deadline with your fat ultralight. Now what? I'm Paul Flagg, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this Aero News special feature, and thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Earl Lawrence, who is the Experimental Aircraft Association's Vice President for Industry and Regulatory Affairs. And we're here to talk about what happened on January 30th, which there was plenty of warning, but the deadline expired for owners of overweight ultralight aircraft to submit aircraft registration applications to convert their aircraft to experimental light sport aircraft. We're going to talk about what the significance of that deadline passing is and what the options are for people who missed it. Earl, thanks for taking a few minutes out for us today.
Oh, it's my privilege. And just a quick note, it was January 31st instead of the 30th for us. And everybody had until basically midnight on the 31st. And I'm sure the FAA registration office was up late recording everything that had come in.
I am sorry, you are correct. Your press release was dated January 30th. But
yeah.
let me ask you about that deadline. It was publicized 3 years out.
Yes.
Did the FAA do a good enough outreach job in making sure people knew it was coming?
Well, I think, you know, good enough is a relative term. The FAA did just about everything that they had resources to do themselves. And, you know, that's one of the key things. All the organizations, we have the Aerosports Connection, the United States Ultralight Association, EAA, all of us who had ultralight exemptions notified all of our folks that were in our exemption, all the pilots that had registered with us, we put it in our magazines and things like that. The FAA built up, and I participated in training over 100 new designated airworthiness representatives to certificate the aircraft, appointed them, got them out in the field. The FAA put together maps. They went to Sun and Fun to register people's airplanes. They came to Oshkosh to register people's airplanes and sent out notices, put a notice in the Federal Register, but stuff up on their website. You know, it was a massive effort. But, you know, even with all that, you still never cover all the bases. There's always one area of the country that doesn't get to have somebody who can certificate your aircraft, or, you know, a group of folks that we don't get to because a particular club or whatever don't really understand the impact or fully understand everything that was involved.
Well, I have to say that something I've observed, and my observations come from observing how this has gone over in the experimental gyroplane community, is that the FAA had really targeted this. When they said fat ultralights, they were talking about two-place training aircraft that, if they were being flown legally now, were operating under an exemption from either EAA or ASC. And mm-hmm. So one would assume that these folks, you know, were in contact enough with the community to know this was coming. Mm-hmm. But I think the FAA was, if anything, generous in allowing people with overweight single-place ultralights to fall under this category. And some of those guys, frankly, were sitting out on a farm somewhere, don't belong to any organizations, never get on the internet to check things, and frankly, we're just out of touch.
Yeah, and you know, that's what happened, I think, in part of this. And, you know, a lot of people were waking up at the last minute. Also, I think there was a lot of hope out there that the FAA wasn't serious about the deadline and they would extend it. And there were so lots of discussions about that out in the chat rooms, and so some people said, you know, I'm going to wait a little bit to see what happens. But I think you're true. There's folks out there that just never heard anything about it, and you know, learned at the very last minute when the word finally got to them, and is part of what our exemption was trying to address. And an interesting thing. When the exemption was issued, the FAA specifically said that whoever uses the exemption must be a current member of an organization.
Right.
And they did that for just what you were saying, because what they were concerned about is they says, you know, our problem wasn't the people who belonged to the associations, because, you know, they got word one way or another. I mean, whether they took action was up to them, but they were notified. And, you know, that's one of, I thought it was kind of interesting. We didn't even ask for that. And the FAA specifically put in there that says, no, if they want to take advantage of the exemption that we received to let certifications occur after the date, that individual needs to be a member of the organization, and they're doing that to encourage people to participate in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to improve safety and information flow.
Well, and there was also a distracting discussion going on, and I think, I don't know if it was an urban myth or not, maybe you can straighten me out on this, but there has mm-hmm. been talk for quite a while that there might be some adjustment in the 254-pound limit for ultralights. did that even originate with anything the FAA actually said?
No, it didn't originate from the FAA whatsoever. And in fact, I remember sitting with Mr. Balog. He's the head of flight standards for the FAA in Oshkosh. After the 1 year, not even 1 year, you know, about six months after or the final rule was passed, in that year he sat down in a room with all the organizations. You know, we had the Gyro Association included in that with ASC, USUA, EA. We all sat in a room and he made it absolutely positively clear that wasn't changing and that the date wasn't changing, and go tell all your members that. And it is, like you said, people get discussing these on the chat rooms and hope springs eternal.
Yes. Well, it doesn't spring eternal anymore. Let's talk about now what happens now that we have come up on this date. Who exactly is affected by this?
Well, who's affected by the date are those individuals who own an aircraft, and I'm using that in the congressional definition, which is anything with the intention of leaving the ground, that was being operated as an ultralight previously. And so if you're one of those individuals and you have an aircraft and it doesn't meet the 254 pound requirement of Part 103, single place, two place, whatever it may be. But if you're outside of that definition, you need to be an aircraft. There's no outlet. There's no exemption or anything else that gives you an opportunity. And then, you know, in essence, this rule was a grandfather period. When the passage of the sport pilot rule, they said, hey, all those, we're not going to ask how you came about in existence or where you've been flying or what you've been doing, but those aircraft out there that don't meet 103 and for whatever reason were not licensed as an aircraft within the system, we'll give you 3 years to come into the system and we'll give you a category to go into and you can continue to operate. But so here's an opportunity to get legal.
And really what this was for so-called fat ultralights that had been operated as trainers under the exemptions through ASC or EAA, this was a grandfather program for aircraft which had been flying claiming to be ultralights that weren't. This was actually a kind of amnesty program.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good way to phrase it. It was an amnesty program, and it's really a wonderful thing that the agency gave everybody. It was a great opportunity. I mean, and when I say great opportunity, everything comes with its pluses and minuses. You know, as I explained to the FAA early, they were wondering why people didn't hurry up and register. And I said, well, the minute you register, your state finds out about it, and then your state tax man comes looking for you, and they want to know, you know, what did you pay on the purchase of this aircraft that you have?
And that's assuming you didn't fly to Maine.
Exactly. And you know, so you could understand the resistance and also, you know, if you owned one of those aircraft and you've been flying, I mean, you don't think of this amnesty thing as maybe not so great because now I got to pay property tax on my aircraft. And,
right.
You know, so there's some disadvantages there. So, you know, it's not all wonderful. But it did. I think the key thing is you went from being illegal to legal. And, you know, I think that's worth paying a little bit in property taxes.
Well, and you know, if you can find a way to make weight, you still had 3 years to try to make that happen too.
That's absolutely true also. And you know, you can see there's more and more of true ultralights popping up every day. I saw some down at Sebring here a few weeks ago. Some wonderful new designs. Look like a lot of fun, and certainly things that I wouldn't hesitate jumping in and going flying, and I'm sure a lot of other folks will take advantage of that also. Very reasonably priced, too.
My guest today is Earl Lawrence, who is the Vice President for Industry and Regulatory Affairs for the Experimental Aircraft Association. We'll be back with more on Fat Ultralights in a moment. I'm Paul Plack. You're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Uncramp your style in a new Citation CJ2 Plus from Cessna. Now with integrated ProLine 21 avionics, FADEC, and a restyled cockpit and cabin. In the CJ2 Plus, you'll carry more payload than you could in the original CJ2. You'll climb and cruise faster. You'll have the freedom to use even shorter runways, and you'll do it all on less fuel. For a sure thing, call 1-800-4-CESSNA.
Diamond's DA-42 Twin Star is General Aviation's ultimate flying machine. Fly fast with the confidence of a twin for the cost of a single. Go direct over water or rugged terrain and cover great distances in the first and only piston aircraft with an advanced airframe, avionics, and engines. The DA-42 gives you options you've never had before, including the Garmin G1000 and no ice protection. Go where you want, when you want, fast and for less. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3220.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Earl Lawrence, who is EAA's VP of Industry and Regulatory Affairs. We're talking about the plight that now has befallen those who procrastinated and missed the January 31st deadline to get their Fat Ultralights registered as experimental light sport aircraft. Earl, in the latest edition of eHotline, there was mention of a couple of options that still exist for these folks. Let's tick down them one by one. One is the amateur build option. How is this an option still for people who are in this circumstance?
Oh, sure. This is a great option for many people out there. Let's back up. Remember, even if you registered your aircraft but didn't certificate it, there's still the EAA exemption, okay? Now, if you didn't register and you didn't certificate, you're completely past it, and there's the opportunity to meet the amateur built rule, and that simply was the major portion of your aircraft built by amateurs. And the other part of that is, do you have evidence to back up that statement? Mm-hmm. And if you have that evidence, then you can do that. I mean, if you were the individual who bought a kit and you assembled it, things like Legal Eagles and Challengers, and you know, there's a good number of aircraft out there that we called ultralights that can qualify to be amateur built. And, you know, so that's one step. The tough thing out there for a lot of these folks is they're the second or third owner. And one of the things the FAA registry is going to insist on is a chain of ownership. Mm-hmm. You have to show that the receipt from the kit company to the first owner, and then, you know, from the second, you know, first owner to the second owner, you have to show who's owned the aircraft or the kit before the FAA will register it as an amateur build. But it's a great option. You can get your repairman certificate as the builder, so you can do the annual inspection on the thing. And you know, it's still out there, and it doesn't go away, and there's no deadline on that one.
Okay, the one thing that is lost in that process, though, is if you buy a used experimental amateur build aircraft, mm-hmm. assuming that you've got all the bills of sale and the original builder's log and can complete the document trail, if you did not build it, you still cannot get the repairman certificate, and you also cannot qualify to do the annual in the same way you would if it was a experimental light sport aircraft.
Well, that's partially true. The requirement for the repairman certificate isn't that you built the entire aircraft. Remember, as applying for it, it's that you show that you participated in the certification of the aircraft and that you have the requisite skills. And so if you did nothing on the aircraft, okay, I agree with you. But maybe, you know, you're the second or third owner and it was already flying, but you had to completely recover it and redo the, you know, replace certain parts. Maybe you repaired it. Maybe you did an engine overhaul. And you can present that as evidence to the FAA, and it will be an FAA inspector's judgment call as whether you, as the applicant, has sufficient knowledge to obtain the repairman certificate. There's only one repairman certificate issued per amateur belt. So again, if it was certificated previously as an amateur belt, no. But if you're the first person who's applying for that amateur belt certificate, you have an opportunity to show to the FAA that you have the experience to qualify for that repairman certificate.
And I suppose there are, I mean, there is the handful of experimentals out there. You know, I don't know how many of them would have been flying as fat ultralights, but for example, somebody builds an RV4 and never intends to do his own annuals because, mm-hmm. you know, he's just, it comes from a world where every year you take it to somebody who really knows what they're doing. he may, you know, somebody like that may have built a plane and never gotten around to, you know, just overlooked applying for the repairman certificate at the time it was registered.
They could, but in that case, if they're the ones who applied for the airworthiness certificate now, okay, they're the only, that's really the key. Who signed the application for the airworthiness certificate? So if they sell that to another person, that other person can't say, oh, I want to get a repairman certificate even though I wasn't one, you know, I wasn't the original builder.
Okay. Well, this sounds like a great opportunity to decide to upgrade your aircraft if you buy it used and maybe do some recovering or that sort of thing.
Well, you know, again, you know, possibly. And the key in that, I know this can be confusing in this discussion, is it's the individual who signs that the aircraft is in a condition for safe operation when they apply for that airworthiness certificate. So it's a particular part on that airworthiness certificate, and if you sign that, you can then on top of that convince an FAA inspector that you have the knowledge, you've got an opportunity to get that repairman certificate.
All right, let's move on to the other major option, and this one is probably far less desirable, but I don't think a lot of our listeners even know about this category to know why it's undesirable, and that's to register it as experimental exhibition. This is outside the home-built arena, pretty much,
yes.
So it isn't really EAA's bread and butter. But I think a lot of air show aircraft that we see are flown this way. I think some warbirds probably are. Tell us what the experimental exhibition category is and what the drawbacks are.
Oh, absolutely. You know, exhibition category is just what the name says. It's to exhibit unusual aircraft. Okay. A lot of, as you mentioned, a lot of people don't realize experimental, it has a whole bunch of different categories. There's experimental amateur built, there's experimental crew training, experimental R&D, experimental kit built, that's actually a different category, experimental light sport aircraft, experimental exhibition is just one more of those categories, and it's intended for those aircraft that are intended to be exhibited. Now, if you've got yourself a B-25, doesn't have to be, but that's certainly something that's an exhibit wherever it shows up. So it's not too hard to explain to the FAA that you know, hey, look at wherever I go, I draw a lot of people looking at my aircraft because mm-hmm. it's an interesting thing. There's also, if you're using it to make movies or, you know, something like that, that's an exhibit. If you're an air show act, obviously that's an exhibit. And the agency provides different operating limitations based upon the history of the aircraft and what its intended use are. And that's what makes it undesirable for an ultralight trainer, because if you follow the FAA policy as it's written today, if it's not a World War II aircraft, if it's not an aircraft built before 1946, you know, so there's some antiques that are put in exhibition and
right.
or designed back there, they put you into what's called Group 4, which means you get to land and take off from your home airport, and you get to go to events for which you've notified the FAA once a year which events you're going to go to. So you can go to air shows, public events, things where aircraft are being exhibited, because, again, the intention of this is that you take your aircraft someplace to be exhibited. So it's not a wonderful category to go into, but it is sort of the last resort. And the FAA has also used it in the past reluctantly to help people out, and, you know, when they had no other category to stick it in, they put it in that category, mm-hmm. and there's been different sets of operating limitations issued in the past, but, you know, we're not really expecting to have much of an opportunity there this time, and we'll see what the FAA has not indicated that they're changing their policy on this as it sits right now, so if you were to go that route with one of these aircraft and you're not an air show act and you don't have something really unusual, chances are you're going to get landing and takeoff from your home airport.
Well, and in all fairness, a lot of ultralights are flown that way.
Yes.
So it might not be the end of the world. Now, let's get into the idea that there are going to be a lot of people out there who have lawn ornaments, as we've come to call them.
Mm-hmm.
Advertisements, you know, classified ads, you're going to be going through them. You're going to see aircraft that may or may not be obviously in this group. Is EAA going to expend any time and effort to try to screen incoming advertising requests for this sort of thing? And what should we watch for in other medium?
Well, you know, I think the number one thing that anybody should be looking at is that don't buy an aircraft that doesn't already have an airworthiness certificate. It's that simple. And also, when look at what the airworthiness certificate is, and let's just say that somebody has an airworthiness certificate and they had it in the exhibition air, you know, category. You know, that's the kind of thing where you want to ask a few extra questions. And that's where EA and our Aviation Services Department is available every day, you know, answering on the toll-free hotline, kind of walk people through. And anybody looking at buying a used experimental aircraft should give EA a call and ask for help in this area. And they can walk you through just what are the details you need to be looking for. And, you know, I think that's going to be a critical thing. We don't actually have a lot of advertising for many aircraft in our publications. I mean, most of it you see is in Trade a Plane and those type of publications out there. And, you know, I know from experience they do not censor or, you know, they don't see that as their role. It's an aircraft for sale, and they leave it up to the potential purchaser to ensure and they have the requisite knowledge of what they're buying and what it means, what they're buying. So, you know, I think that's another good reason to belong to EA and give us a call, and we'll help with any purchase of an experimental aircraft with making sure that you're educated and you're asking the right questions.
Well, and if you buy something without an airworthiness certificate that claims to be an ultralight, when you go and look at it, take a really big fish scale with you. Because you're going to have to weigh it on the dock.
Well, you know, and that's true. And believe it or not, I mean, if you go back and you look at the FAA advisory circulars for ultralight aircraft, it's an AC-103, it talks about having a statement from an AMP about the qualification of that aircraft as an ultralight, that somebody has weighed it and checked it. They give another procedure other than an AMP where a committee can look into these things, like a committee with EAA or United States Ultralight Association or whatever can do that. But believe it or not, there's actually a provision in there to have a written statement showing that it does qualify. And that's maybe not a bad thing to have if you have an ultralight, especially if you have a FAA official come walking up to you someday and say, geez, you know, I don't know about your machine here. Tell me about this. And shouldn't you have an end number on it? And you can pull this little sheet out, and, you know, it's in the format in the FAA advisory circular, and it says, well, you know, I followed the advisory circular, and here's my statement showing that it's actually, this is a 103 machine.
Yeah, I guess what it comes down to is you're going to want a piece of paper from somebody on any aircraft you buy from now on.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Well, Earl, we really appreciate your taking a few minutes out to talk to our listeners today about this topic. I'm sure it has caught a few people off guard. And we appreciate EAA's work on this project, and we'll hope to talk to you again soon.
Well, thank you. It's my privilege and to talk with everyone. And again, anybody have any questions, give EAA a call.
Earl Lawrence is the Vice President for Industry and Regulatory Affairs for the Experimental Aircraft Association. You can find out more about EAA at www.eaa.org. You've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. You can find us on the web at www.aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.